grimly.
He knew in advance what was going to happen.
Luke looked at Leia, at the strain in her face and sense. You realize what you're saying, he said quietly. You're accusing a member of the Council of being an Imperial agent. Leia's sense seemed to flinch. Hans didn't even flicker.
Yeah, I know, Hans said. Isn't that what he's accusing Akbar of?
The problem is timing, Han, Leia said, her tone one of strained patience. As I've already tried to explain, if we accuse Phalia of anything now, it'll just look like we're trying to take the pressure off Akbar by turning Phalia's charges back against him. Even if it were true, and I don't think it is, it would still come across as a cheap and rather mindless trick.
Maybe that's why he was so quick to finger Akbar in the first place, Han countered. So that we couldn't turn it back on him. That ever occur to you?
Yes, it has, Leia said. Unfortunately, it doesn't change the situation. Until we've cleared Akbar, we can't go making accusations against Phalia.
Han snorted.
Come on, Leia. Political waddle-footing is fine in its place, but we're talking about the survival of the New Republic here.
Which could fall completely apart over this without anyone ever firing a shot, Leia retorted hotly. Face it, Han. This whole thing is still being held together with hope and crating tape. You get a few wild accusations flying around, and half the races in the old Rebel Alliance might decide to pull out and go their separate ways.
Luke cleared his throat.
Ahem. If I can say something?
They looked at him, the tension in the room fading a little.
Sure, kid. What is it?
Han said.
I think we all agree that whatever his agenda or possible sponsors, Phalia is up to something, Luke said. Maybe it would help to find out what that something is. Leia, what do we know about Phalia?
She shrugged.
He's a Bothan, obviously, though he grew up on the Bothan colony world of Kothless instead of Bothui proper. He joined the Rebel Alliance right after the Battle of Yavin, bringing a good-sized group of his fellow Bothans in with him. His people served mainly in support and reconnaissance, though they saw some occasional action, too. He was involved in a number of wide-ranging interstellar business activities before joining the Alliance. Shipping, merchandising, some mining, assorted other ventures. I'm pretty sure he's kept up with some of them since then, but I don't know which ones.
Are they on file? Luke asked.
She shook her head.
I've been through his file 5 times, and I've checked every other reference to him I could find. Nothing.
That's where we want to start our backtrack, then, Han decided. Quiet business stuff is always good for digging up dirt.
Leia threw him a patient look.
It's a big galaxy, Han. We don't even know where to start looking.
I think we can figure it out, Han assured her. You said the Bothan saw some action after Yavin. Where?
Any number of places, Leia said, frowning.
She swiveled the computer around to face her, tapped in a command.
Let's see.
You can skip any battle they were ordered into, Han told her. Also any time there were only a few of them there as part of a big multi-species force. I just want the places where a bunch of Phalia's people really threw themselves into it.
It was clear from Leia's face that she didn't see where Han was going with this, a sentiment Luke could readily identify with. But she fed in the parameters without comment.
Well, I suppose the only one that really qualifies would be a short but violent battle off New Cov, in the Cherba sector. 4 Bothan ships took on a Victory-class Star Destroyer that was snooping around, keeping it busy until a Star Cruiser could come to their assistance.
New Cov, huh?
Han repeated thoughtfully.
That system get mentioned anywhere in Phalia's business stuff?
No, it doesn't.
Fine, Han nodded. Then that's where we start.
Leia threw Luke a blank look.
Did I miss something?
Oh, come on, Leia, Han said. You said yourself that Bothans pretty much sat out of the real war everywhere they could. They didn't take on a Victory Star Destroyer at New Cov just for the fun of it. They were protecting something.
Leia frowned.
I think you're reaching.
Maybe, Han agreed. Maybe not. Suppose it was Phalia and not the Imperials that sneaked that money into Akbar's account. Transferring a block fund through Polani from the Cherba sector would be easier than sending it from any of the Imperial systems.
That takes us back to accusing Phalia of being an Imperial agent, Luke warned.
Maybe not, Han argued. Could be the timing of the transfer was coincidence. Or maybe one of the Bothans got a whiff of the Empire's intentions, and Phalia figured he could use it to take down Akbar.
Leia shook her head.
It's still nothing we can take to the Council, she said.
I'm not gonna take it to the Council, Han told her. I'm gonna take Luke, and we're going to go to New Cov and check it out ourselves. Quiet-like.
Leia looked at Luke, an unspoken question forming in her mind.
There's nothing I can do here to help, he said. It's worth a look anyway.
All right, Leia sighed. But keep it quiet.
Han gave her a tight grin.
Trust me.
He raised an eyebrow at Luke.
You ready?
Luke blinked.
You mean right now?
Sure, why not? Leia's got the political end covered here, okay?
There was a flicker of sense from Leia, and Luke looked over just in time to see her wince. Her eyes met Luke's, her sense pleading with him to keep quiet.
What is it?
He asked her silently. Whether she would have answered him or not, he never found out. From over at the door, Chewbacca growled out the whole story. Han turned to stare at his wife, his mouth falling open.
You promised what?
He breathed. She swallowed visibly.
Han, I had no choice.
No choice? No choice? I'll give you a choice. No, you're not going.
Han,
excuse me, Luke interrupted, standing up. I have to go check out my X-Wing. I'll see you both later.
Sure, kid,
Han growled, not looking at him. Luke stepped to the door, catching Chewbacca's eye as he passed and nodding toward the outer office. Clearly the Wookiee had already come to the same conclusion. Heaving his massive bulk to his feet, he followed Luke from the room. The door slid shut behind them, and for a long moment they just stared at each other. Leia broke the silence first.
I have to go, Han, she said softly. I promised Kabarak I'd meet him. Don't you understand?
No, I don't understand,
Han retorted, trying hard to hold on to his temper. The gut-wrenching fear he'd felt after the near miss on Biffash was back, churning hard at his stomach. Fear for Leia's safety, and the safety of the twins she carried, his son and daughter.
These whatever they are's...
Nogri,
she supplied the word.
These Nogri have been taking pot shots at you every chance they've had for a couple of months now. You remember Biffash? And that mock-up of the Falcon they tried to sucker us into getting aboard? And the attack on Bimisari before that? They came within a hair of snatching us right out of the middle of a marketplace. If it hadn't been for Luke and Chewie, they'd have done it too. These guys are serious, Leia. And now you tell me you want to fly out alone and visit their planet? You might as well turn yourself over to the Empire and save some time.
I wouldn't be going if I thought that, she insisted. Kabarak knows I'm Darth Vader's daughter. And for whatever reason, that seems to be very important to them. Maybe I can use that leverage to turn them away from the Empire and onto our side. Anyway, I have to try.
Han snorted.
What is this, some kind of crazy Jedi thing? Luke was always getting all noble and charging off into trouble, too.
Leia reached over to lay her hand on his arm.
Han, I know it's a risk, she said quietly, but it may be the only chance we ever have of resolving this. The Nogri need help. Kabarak admitted that. If I can give them that help, if I can convince them to come over to our side, that'll mean one less enemy for us to have to deal with.
She hesitated.
And I can't keep running forever.
What about the twins?
He had the guilty satisfaction of seeing her wince.
I know,
she said, a shiver running through her as she reached her other hand up to hold her belly.
But what's the alternative? To lock them away in a tower of the palace somewhere with a ring of Wookiee guards around them? They'll never have any chance of a normal life as long as the Nogri are trying to take them from us.
Han gritted his teeth. So she knew. He hadn't been sure before, but he was now. Leia knew that what the Empire had been after this whole time was her unborn children. And knowing that, she still wanted to meet with the Empire's agents. For a long minute he gazed at her, his eyes searching the features of that face he'd grown to love so deeply over the years, his memory bringing up images of the past as he did so. The young determination in her face, as in the middle of a blazing firefight, she'd grabbed Luke's blaster rifle away from him and shot them an escape route into the Death Star's detention-level garbage chute. The sound of her voice, in the middle of a deadly danger at Jabba's, helping him through the blindness and tremor and disorientation of hibernation sickness. The wiser, more mature determination, visible through the pain in her eyes, as lying wounded outside the indoor bunker, she had nevertheless summoned the skill and control to coolly shoot two stormtroopers off Han's back. And he remembered, too, the wrenching realization he'd had at that same time, that no matter how much he tried, he would never be able to totally protect her from the dangers and risks of the universe. Because no matter how much he might love her, no matter how much he might give of himself to her, she could never be content with that alone. Her vision extended beyond him, just as it extended beyond herself, to all the beings of the galaxy. And to take that away from her, whether by force or even by persuasion, would be to diminish her soul, and to take away part of what he'd fallen in love with in the first place.
"Can I at least go with you?"
he asked quietly. She reached up to caress his cheek, smiling her thanks through the sudden moisture in her eyes.
"I promised I'd go alone,"
she whispered, her voice tight with emotion.
"Don't worry. I'll be all right."
"Sure."
Abruptly, Han got to his feet.
"Well, if you're going, you're going. Come on. I'll help you get the Falcon prepped."
"The Falcon?"
she repeated.
"But I thought you were going to Nukov."
"I'll take Lando's ship," he called over his shoulder as he strode to the door. "I've got to get it back to him anyway."
"But..."
"No argument," he cut her off. "If this Nogri of yours has something besides talking in mind, you'll stand a better chance in the Falcon than you will in the Lady Luck."
He opened the door and stepped into the reception area, and stopped short. Standing directly between him and the door, looking for all the world like a giant hairy thundercloud, Chewbacca was glowering at him.
"What?"
Han demanded. The Wookiee's comment was short, sharp, and very much to the point.
"Well, I don't like it much either,"
Han told him bluntly.
"What do you want me to do, lock her up somewhere?"
He felt Leia come up behind him.
"I'll be all right, Chewie,"
she assured him.
"Really, I will."
Chewbacca growled again, making it abundantly clear what he thought of her assessment.
"You got any suggestions? Let's hear 'em,"
Han said. Not surprisingly, he did.
"Chewie, I'm sorry,"
Leia said.
"I promised Kabarak I'd come alone."
Chewbacca shook his head violently, showing his teeth as he growled his opinion of that idea.
He doesn't like it,"
Han translated diplomatically.
"I got the gist, thank you,"
Leia retorted.
"Listen, you two, for the last time..."
Chewbacca cut her off with a bellow that made her jump half a meter backward.
"You know, sweetheart,"
Han said,
"I really think you ought to let him go with you. At least as far as the rendezvous point,"
he added quickly as she threw him a glare.
"Come on. You know how seriously Wookiees take this life debt thing. You need a pilot anyway."
For just a second, he could see the obvious counter-argument in her eyes, that she was perfectly capable of flying the Falcon herself. But only for a second.
"All right," she sighed. "I guess Kabarak won't object to that. But once we reach the rendezvous, Chewie, you do as I tell you, whether you like it or not. Agreed?"
The Wookiee thought about it, rumbled agreement.
"Okay,"
Leia said, sounding relieved.
"Let's get going then. 3PO?
"Yes, Your Highness."
For once he'd had the brains to sit quietly at the reception desk and keep his loose change out of the discussion. It was a marked improvement over his usual behavior, Han decided. Maybe he ought to let Chewbacca get angry more often.
I want you to come with me, too, Leia told the droid. Kabarak spoke Basic well enough, but the other Nogri may not, and I don't want to have to depend on their translators to make myself understood.
Of course, Your Highness,
3PO said, tilting his head slightly to the side.
Good.
Leia turned to look up at Han, licked her lips.
I guess we'd better get going.
There were a million things he could have said to her. A million things he wanted to say.
I guess,
he said instead.
You'd better.
Chapter 5
You'll forgive me,
Mara said conversationally as she finished the last bit of wiring on her comm board,
if I say that as a hideout, this place stinks.
Card shrugged as he hefted a sensor pack out of its box and set it down on the side table with an assortment of other equipment.
I agree, it's not Merkur, he said. On the other hand, it has its compensations. Who'd ever think of looking for a smuggler's nest in the middle of a swamp?
I'm not referring to the ship drop, Mara told him, reaching beneath her loose-flowing tunic sleeve to readjust the tiny blaster sheathed to her left forearm. I mean this place.
Ah, this place.
Card glanced out the window.
I don't know. A little public, perhaps, but that too has its compensations.
A little public?
Mara echoed, looking out the window herself at the neat row of cream-white buildings barely 5 meters away and the crowds of brightly clad humans and aliens hurrying along just outside.
You call this a little public?
Calm down, Mara, Card said. When the only viable places to live on a planet are a handful of deep valleys, of course things are going to get a bit crowded. The people here are used to it, and they've learned how to give each other a reasonable degree of privacy. Anyway, even if they wanted to snoop, it wouldn't do them much good.
Mirror glass won't stop a good sensor probe, Mara countered. And crowds mean cover for Imperial spies.
The Imperials have no idea where we are.
He paused and threw her an odd look.
Unless you know differently.
Mara turned away. So that was how it was going to be this time. Previous employers had reacted to her strange hunches with fear or anger or simple bald-faced hatred. Card, apparently, was going to go for polite exploitation.
I can't turn it on and off like a sensor pack, she growled over her shoulder.
Not anymore.
Ah,
Card said. The word implied he understood. The tone indicated otherwise.
Interesting. Is this a remnant of some previous Jedi training?
She turned to look at him.
Tell me about the ships.
He frowned.
Excuse me?
The ships, she repeated. The capital warships that you were very careful not to tell Grand Admiral Thrawn about back when he visited us on Merkur. You promised to give me the details later. This is later.
He studied her, a slight smile creasing his lips.
All right, he said. Have you heard of the Katana fleet?
She had to search her memory.
That was the group also called the Dark Force, wasn't it? Something like 200 Dreadnought-class heavy cruisers that were lost about 10 years before the Clone Wars broke out. All the ships were fitted with some kind of new-style full-rig slave circuitry. And when the system malfunctioned, the whole fleet jumped to light-speed together and disappeared.
Nearly right, Card said. The dreadnoughts of that era, in particular, were ridiculously crew-intensive ships, requiring upwards of 16,000 men each. The full-rig slave circuitry on the Katana ships cut that complement down to around 2,000.
Mara thought about the handful of dreadnought cruisers she'd known.
Must have been an expensive conversion.
It was.
Card nodded. Particularly since they played it as much for public relations as they did for pure military purposes. They redesigned the entire Dreadnought interior for the occasion, from the equipment and interior decor, right down to the dark gray hull surfacing. That last was the origin of the nickname, Dark Force. Incidentally, though there was some suggestion that it referred to the smaller number of interior lights a 2,000 crewer ship would need. At any rate, it was the Old Republic's grand demonstration of how effective a slave-rigged fleet could be. Mara snorted. Some demonstration.
Agreed, Card said dryly.
But the problem wasn't in the slave circuitry itself. The records are a little vague, suppressed by those in charge at the time, no doubt. But it appears that one or more of the fleet's crewers picked up a hive virus at one of the ports of call on their maiden voyage. It was spread throughout all 200 ships while in dormant state, which meant that when it suddenly flared up, it took down nearly everybody at once. Mara shivered. She'd heard of hive viruses leveling whole planetary populations in pre-Clone Wars days, before the medical science of the Old Republic and later the Empire had finally figured out how to deal with the things. So it killed the crews before they could get to help. Apparently in a matter of hours. Though that's just an educated guess, Card said. What turned the whole thing from a disaster into a debacle was the fact that this particular hive virus had the charming trait of driving its victims insane just before it killed them. The dying crewers lasted just long enough to slave their ships together. Which meant that when the Katana command crew also went crazy and took off, the entire fleet went with them.
I remember now, Mara nodded slowly. That was supposedly what started the big movement toward decentralization and automated ship functions. Away from big, all-powerful computers into hundreds of droids.
The movement was already on its way, but the Katana fiasco pretty well sealed the outcome, Card said. Anyway, the fleet disappeared somewhere into the depths of interstellar space and was never heard from again. It was a big news item for a while, with some of the less reverent members of the media making snide wordplays on the Dark Force name. And for a few years, it was considered a hot prospect by salvage teams who had more enthusiasm than good sense. Once it finally dawned on them just how much empty space was available in the galaxy to lose a couple hundred ships in, the flurry of interest ended. At any rate, the Old Republic soon had bigger problems on its hands. Aside from the occasional con artist who'd try to sell you a map of its location, you never hear about the fleet anymore.
Right.
It was, of course, obvious now where Card was going with this.
So how did you happen to find it?
Purely by accident, I assure you. In fact, it wasn't until several days afterward that I realized what exactly I'd found. I suspect none of the rest of the crew ever knew at all.
Card's gaze defocused, his eyes flattening with the memory.
It was just over 15 years ago, he said, his voice distant, the thumbs of his intertwined hands rubbing slowly against each other. I was working as navigator/sensor specialist for a small independent smuggling group. We'd rather botched a pickup and had to shoot our way past a pair of Karak cruisers on our way out. We made it all right. But since I hadn't had time to do a complete light-speed calculation, we dropped back to real space a half-light-year out to recalculate. His lip twitched. Imagine our surprise when we discovered a pair of dreadnoughts waiting directly in our path.
Lying dead in space.
Card shook his head.
Actually, they weren't, which was what threw me for those first few days. From all appearances, the ship seemed to be fully functional, with both interior and running lights showing, and even a standby sensor scan in operation. Naturally, we assumed it was part of the group we just tangled with, and the captain made an emergency jump to light speed to get us out of there. Not a good idea, Mara murmured. It seemed the lesser of two evils at the time, Card said grimly. As it turned out, we came close to being fatally wrong on that account. The ship hit the mass shadow of a large comet on the way out, blowing the main hyperdrive and nearly wrecking the rest of the ship on the spot. Five of our crew were killed in the collision, and another three died of injuries before we could limp back to civilization on the backup hyperdrive. There was a moment of silence.
How many of you were left?
Mara asked at last. Card focused on her, his usual sardonic smile back on his face.
Or, in other words, who else might know about the fleet?
If you want to put it that way.
There were six of us left. As I said, though, I don't think any of the others realized what it was we'd found.
It was only when I went back to the sensor records and discovered that there were considerably more than just the two dreadnoughts in the area that I began to have my own suspicions.
And the records themselves?
I erased them, after memorizing the coordinates, of course. Mara nodded.
You said this was 15 years ago?
That's right. Card nodded back. I've thought about going back and doing something with the ships, but I never had the time to do it properly. Unloading 200 dreadnoughts on the open market isn't something you rush into without a good deal of prior preparation. Even if you have markets for all of them, which has always been problematic.
Until now.
He cocked an eyebrow.
Are you suggesting I sell them to the Empire?
They're in the market for capital ships, she reminded him. And they're offering value plus 20%.
He cocked an eyebrow at her.
I thought you didn't much care for the Empire.
I don't, she retorted. What's the other option? Give them to the New Republic?
He held her gaze.
That might be more profitable in the long run.
Mara's left hand curled into a tight fist, her stomach churning with mixed feelings. To let the dreadnoughts fall into the hands of the New Republic, successor to the Rebel Alliance that had destroyed her life, was a hateful thought. But on the other hand, the Empire without the Emperor was only a pale shadow of its former self, hardly even worthy of the name anymore. It would be pearls before swine to give the Dark Force to them. Or would it? With a Grand Admiral in charge of the Imperial fleet again, perhaps there was now a chance for the Empire to regain some of its old glory. And if there was...
What are you going to do? She asked Card.
At the moment, nothing, Card said. It's the same problem we face with Skywalker, after all. The Empire will be swifter to exact vengeance if we go against them, but the New Republic looks more likely to win in the end. Giving Thrawn the Katana fleet would only delay the inevitable. The most prudent course right now is to stay neutral.
Except that giving Thrawn the dreadnoughts might get him off our exhaust trail, Mara pointed out. That would be worth the trade right there.
Card smiled faintly.
Oh, come now, Mara. The Grand Admiral may be a tactical genius, but he's hardly omniscient. He can't possibly have any idea where we are. And he certainly has more important things to do than spend his resources chasing us down.
I'm sure he does,
Mara agreed reluctantly.
But she couldn't help remembering how, even at the height of his power, and with 1,000 other concerns, the Emperor had still frequently taken the time to exact vengeance on someone who'd crossed him.
Beside her, the comm board buzzed, and Mara reached over to key the channel.
Yes?
Lacton.
A familiar voice came from the speaker.
Is Card around?
Right here, Card called, stepping to Mara's side. How's the camouflage work going?
We're about done,
Lacton said.
We ran short of flash netting, though. Do we have any more?
There's some at one of the dumps, Card told him. I'll send Mara to get it. Can you have someone come in to pick it up?
Sure, no problem. I'll send Danken. He hasn't got much to do at the moment anyway.
All right. The netting will be ready by the time he gets here.
Card gestured, and Mara keyed off the channel.
You know where the number 3 dump is?
He asked her. She nodded. 412 Waswashi Street. 3 blocks west and 2 north.
Right. He peered out the window. Unfortunately, it's still too early for repulsor lift vehicles to be on the streets. You'll have to walk.
That's all right, Mara assured him. She felt like a little exercise anyway. 2 boxes be enough?
If you can handle that many, he told her,
looking her up and down as if making sure her outfit conformed to local Rishi standards of propriety. He needn't have bothered. One of the first rules the Emperor had drummed into her so long ago was to blend in as best she could with her surroundings.
If not, Lacton can probably make do with one.
All right, I'll see you later.
Their townhouse was part of a row of similar structures, abutting one of the hundreds of little market areas that dotted the whole congested valley. For a moment, Mara stood in the entry alcove of their building, out of the busy flow of pedestrian traffic, and looked around her. Through the gaps between the nearest buildings, she could see the more distant parts of the city vale, most of it composed of the same cream-white stone so favored by the locals. In places, she could see all the way to the edge. A few small buildings perched precariously partway up the craggy mountains that rose sharply into the sky on all sides. Far up those mountains, she knew, lived loose avian tribes of native Rishi, who no doubt looked down in bemused disbelief at the strange creatures who had chosen the most uncomfortably hot and humid spots of their planet in which to live. Dropping her gaze from the mountains, Mara gave the immediate area a quick scan. Across the street were more townhouses. Between her and them was the usual flow of brightly clad pedestrians hurrying to and from the market area to the east. Reflexively, her eyes flicked across the townhouses, though with each window composed of mirror glass, there wasn't a lot for her to see. Also reflexively, she glanced across each of the narrow pedestrian alleyways between the buildings. Between two of them, back at the building's rear, where he was hardly visible, was the motionless figure of a man wearing a blue scarf and patterned green tunic, staring in her direction. Mara let her gaze drift on, as if she hadn't seen him, her heart thudding suddenly in her throat. Stepping out of the alcove, she turned east toward the market and joined the flow of traffic. She didn't stay with it long, though. As soon as she was out of the mysterious loiterer's line of sight, she began cutting her way across the flow, heading across the street toward the townhouse row. She reached it 3 buildings down from the loiterer, ducked into the alleyway, and hurried toward the rear. If he was indeed monitoring Card's place, there was a good chance she could take him from behind. She reached the rear of the buildings and circled around, only to find that her quarry had vanished. For a moment she stood there, looking around her for any sign of the man's whereabouts, wondering what to do now. There was none of the insistent tingling that had gotten them away from Merkur at the last second. But as she'd told Card, it wasn't a talent she could turn on and off. She looked down at the ground where the man had been standing. There were a few faint footprints in the thin coating of dust that had collected at the corner of the townhouse, giving the impression that the man had been there long enough to shuffle his feet a few times. A half dozen steps away, right in the center of another layer of dust, was a clear footprint pointing toward the west, behind the row of townhouses. Mara looked in that direction, feeling her lip twist. A deliberate lead-on. Obviously, footprints in dust never came out that clear and unsmudged, unless carefully planted. And she was right. 100 meters directly ahead, strolling casually along the rear of the buildings toward a north-south street, was the man in the blue scarf and patterned tunic. A not very subtle invitation to follow him.
Okay, friend, she thought as she started off after him. You want to play? Let's play.
She had closed the gap between them to perhaps 90 meters when he reached the cross flow of traffic and turned north into it.
another clear invitation, this time to close the gap further, lest she lose him. But Mara had no intention of taking him up on this one. She'd memorized the geography of the City Vale their first day here, and it was pretty obvious that his intention was to lead her up to the more sparsely populated industrial areas to the north, where presumably he could deal with her without the awkward presence of witnesses. If she could get there first, she might be able to turn things around on him. Double-checking the blaster beneath her left sleeve, she cut through an alley between the buildings to her right and headed north. The valley stretched for nearly 150 kilometers in a roughly east-west direction, but at this point, its north-south dimension was only a few kilometers. Mara kept up her pace, continually revising her course to avoid crowds and other impediments. Gradually, the houses and shops began to give way to light industry, and finally, she judged she'd come far enough. If her quarry had kept with the leisurely pace of a man who didn't want to lose a tracker, she should now have enough time to prepare a little reception for him. There was, of course, always the possibility that he'd shifted to one of the other north-south streets somewhere along the way, changed direction east or west, or even doubled back completely and returned to Card's townhouse. But as she looked carefully around the corner of a building into the street he'd first turned onto, she discovered that his imagination was as limited as his surveillance technique. Halfway down the block, he was crouched motionless behind a row of storage barrels, with his back to her, his blue scarf thrown back out of the way across his patterned green tunic, something that was probably a weapon clutched ready in his hand, waiting, no doubt, for her to stroll into his trap. Amateur, she thought, lip twisting in contempt. Watching him closely, not even bothering with her blaster, she eased around the corner and started silently toward him. "That's far enough," a mocking voice said from behind her. Mara froze. The figure crouched by the barrels ahead of her didn't even twitch. And it was only then that she belatedly realized that it was far too still to be simply waiting in ambush. Far too still, for that matter, to even be alive. Slowly, keeping her arms stretched straight out to her sides, she turned around. The man facing her was of medium height, with a somewhat bulky build and dark, brooding eyes. His undertunic hung open to reveal a light armor vest beneath it. In his hand, of course, was a blaster.
"Well, well, well," he sneered. "What we got here? About time you showed up. I was starting to think you'd gotten lost or something."
"Who are you?" Mara asked.
"Oh, no, Red. I'm the one what's asking the questions here. Not that I need to, of course. That fancy stuff on top pretty well tells me all I need to know."
He gestured with his blaster at her red-gold hair.
"Should have gotten rid of that. Hide it, or dyed it, you know. Dead giveaway. Pardon the expression."
Mara took a careful breath, forcing her muscles to unknot.
"What do you want with me?"
she asked, keeping her voice calm.
"Same thing every man rail wants,"
he grinned slyly.
"A pile of hard gold cash."
She shook her head.
"In that case, I'm afraid you've picked the wrong person. I've only got about 50 on me."
He grinned even wider.
"Cute, Red. But you're wasting your time. I know who you are, all right. You and your pals are gonna make me real rich. Come on, let's go."
Mara didn't move.
"Perhaps we can work a deal,"
she suggested, feeling a drop of sweat trickle down between her shoulder blades. She knew better than to be fooled by the other's careless speech and manner. Whoever and whatever he was, he knew exactly what he was doing. On the plus side, she still had the blaster hidden beneath her sleeve, and she would give long odds that her assailant wouldn't expect that a weapon that potent might be small enough to conceal there. The fact that he hadn't already searched her seemed to confirm that assessment. But whatever she was going to do, she had to do it now, while she was still facing him. Unfortunately, with her hands spread apart, there was no way for her to get at her weapon without telegraphing the movement. Somehow,
she needed to distract him.
A deal, huh?
He asked lazily.
What kind of deal you got in mind? What kind of deal do you want?
She countered.
If there'd been a box anywhere near her feet, she might have been able to scoop it up with her foot and throw it at him.
But though there was a fair amount of junk littering the street in this part of town, nothing suitable was within reach. Her half-boots were firmly fastened around her ankles. Impossible to get loose without him noticing.
Rapidly, she ran through an inventory of items she was carrying or wearing. Nothing.
But the Emperor's intensive training had included direct manipulation of the Force, as well as the long-range communication abilities that had been her primary value to his regime. Those skills had vanished at the moment of his death, reappearing only briefly and erratically in the years since then. But if the sensory tingles and hunches had started again, perhaps the power was back too.
I'm sure we can double whatever you've been offered, she said. Maybe even throw in something extra to sweeten the pot?
His grin turned evil.
That's a real generous offer, Red. Real generous. A lot of men jump on that right away, sure enough. Me?
He lifted the blaster a little higher.
I like staying with a sure thing. Even if it means settling for half the money?
2 meters behind him, piled carelessly up against a retaining wall, was a small stack of scrap metal parts waiting to be picked up. A short length of shield tubing in particular seemed to be rather precariously positioned on one edge of a battered power cell case. Setting her teeth, clearing her thoughts as best she could, Mara reached her mind out toward the tubing.
On my pad, half a sure thing's better than twice or nothing,
the man said.
Anyway, I don't expect you can outbid the Empire.
Mara swallowed. She suspected it from the first, but the confirmation still sent a shiver up her back.
You might be surprised at our resources, she said.
The length of tubing twitched, rolled a couple of millimeters.
Nah, don't think so,
the other said easily.
Come on, let's go.
Mara tilted a finger back toward the dead man crouched at the box behind her.
You mind telling me first what happened here?
Her assailant shrugged.
What's the tale? I needed a decoy. He was a-wandering around the wrong place at the wrong time. In the story.
His grin suddenly vanished.
Enough stolen. Turn around and start walking. Unless you're looking to spite me by making me settle for the death fee instead.
No,
Mara murmured. She took a deep breath, straining with every bit of strength she possessed, knowing that this was her last best chance. And behind her captor, the tubing fell with a muffled clank onto the ground. He was good, all right. The tubing had hardly even finished its fall before he dropped to one knee, spinning around and spraying the area behind him with a splattering of quick cover fire as he searched for whoever was sneaking up on him. It took less than a second for him to recognize his mistake, and with another spray of blaster fire, he spun back again. But 1 second was all Mara needed. His desperate blaster spray was still tracking toward her when she shot him neatly in the head. For a long moment, she just stood there, breathing hard, muscles trembling with reaction. Then, glancing around to make sure no one was running to see what all the commotion was about, she holstered her weapon and knelt down beside him. There was, as she'd expected, precious little to find. An ID, probably forged, giving his name as Dengar Roth, a couple of spare power clips for his blaster, a backup vibroblade knife, a data card and data pad, and some working capital in both local and imperial currency. Stuffing the ID and data card into her tunic, she left the money and weapons where they were and got back to her feet.
There's your twice of nothing,
she muttered, looking down at the body.
Enjoy it.
Her eyes shifted to the piece of shield tubing that had saved her life. She'd been right. The twitches of power, as well as the hunches, were back, which meant the dreams wouldn't be far behind. She swore under her breath. If they came, they came, and there was nothing much she could do except endure them. For the moment, she had other more pressing matters to deal with. Taking one final look around, she headed for home. Card and Danken were waiting when she arrived back at the townhouse, the latter all but pacing the floor in his nervousness.
"Hey, you all!" he snapped as she slipped in through the back door. "Where the blazes?"
"We've got trouble,"
Mar cut him off, handing the Dengar Roth ID to Card and brushing past them to the still largely disassembled communications room. Pushing aside a box of cables, she found a datapad and plugged in the card.
"What kind of trouble?" Card asked, coming up behind her.
"The bounty hunter kind," Mara said, handing him the datapad. Neatly framed in the center of the display, under a large 20,000, was Card's face. "We're probably all in there," she told him, "or at least as many as Grand Admiral Thrawn knew about."
"So, I'm worth 20,000 now," Card murmured, paging quickly through the card. "I'm flattered."
"Is that all you're going to say?" Mara demanded.
He looked at her.
"What would you like me to say?"
he asked mildly.
"That you were right and I was wrong about the Empire's interest in us."
"I'm not interested in laying blame," she told him stiffly. "What I want to know is what we're going to do about it."
Card looked at the datapad again, a muscle tightening briefly in his jaw.
"We're going to do the only prudent thing," he said. "Namely, retreat. Danken, get on the secure comm and tell Lacton to start pulling the drop apart again. Then call Chin and his team and have them go over and repack this stuff in the equipment dumps. You can stay and help Mara and me here. I want to get off Rishi by midnight, if at all possible."
"Got it,"
Danken said, already keying the encrypt codes into the comm board. Card handed the datapad back to Mara.
"We'd better get busy."
She stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"And what happens when we run out of backup bases?"
He locked eyes with her.
"We don't give up the dreadnoughts under duress," he said, lowering his voice to just above a whisper. "Not to Thrawn, not to anyone else."
"We may have to,"
she pointed out. His eyes hardened.
"We may choose to," he corrected her. "We will never have to. Is that clear?"
Mara grimaced to herself.
"Yes."
"Good."
Card flicked a glance over her shoulder to where Danken was speaking urgently into the comm.
"We have a lot of work to do. Let's get to it."
Mara would have bet that they couldn't reassemble their equipment in less than 24 hours. To her mild surprise, the crews had everything packed and ready to go barely an hour after local midnight. With suitably generous applications of funds to spaceport officials, they were off Rishi and to Lightspeed an hour after that. And later that night, as the wild card drove through the mottled sky of hyperspace, the dreams started again.
Chapter 6.
From a distance, it had looked like a standard-issue bulk cruiser. Old, slow, minimally armed, with very little going for it in a fight except its size. But as with so very much of warfare, appearances in this case turned out to be deceiving. And if Grand Admiral Thrawn hadn't been on the Chimera's bridge, Pelion had to admit that he might have been caught a bit by surprise. But Thrawn had been on the bridge, and had recognized immediately the unlikelihood that the rebellion strategists would have put such an important convoy under the protection of such a weak ship. And so, when the bulk cruiser's bay suddenly erupted with three full squadrons of A-wing starfighters, the Chimera's TIE interceptors were already in space and swarming to the attack.
"Interesting tactic,"
Thrawn commented, as the gap between the Chimera and the rebel convoy began to sparkle with laser flashes.
"If not especially innovative. The idea of converting bulk cruisers to starfighter carriers was first proposed over 20 years ago." "I don't recall it ever being implemented,"
Pelion said, feeling a twinge of uneasiness as he eyed the tactical displays. A-wings were faster even than those cursed X-wings, and he wasn't at all sure how well his TIE interceptors would handle them.
"Excellent fighters, A-wings,"
Thrawn said, as if reading Pellion's thoughts.
Not without their limitations, though.
Particularly here. High-speed craft like that are far more suited to hit-and-fade operations than to escort duty. Forcing them to remain near a convoy largely neutralizes their speed advantage. He cocked a blue-black eyebrow at Pellion.
Perhaps we're seeing the result of Admiral Ackbar's removal as Supreme Commander. Perhaps.
The TIE interceptors did indeed seem to be holding their own against the A-wings, and the Chimera itself was certainly having no trouble with the bulk cruiser. Beyond the battlefront, the rest of the convoy was trying to huddle together, as if that would do them any good.
Ackbar's people are still in charge, though, obviously. We've been over this territory already, Captain,
Thrawn said, his voice cooling slightly.
Planting a vacuum-tight collection of evidence against Ackbar would have ruined him far too quickly. The more subtle attack will still neutralize him, but it will also send ripples of uncertainty and confusion through the Rebellion's entire political system. At the very least, it will distract and weaken them just at the moment when we'll be launching the Mount Tantis campaign. At its best, it could split the entire Alliance apart.
He smiled.
Ackbar himself is replaceable, Captain. The delicate political balance the Rebellion has created for itself is not. I understand all that, Admiral,
Pellion growled.
My concern is with your assumption that that Bothan on the Council can be relied upon to push things so close to your theoretical breakup point.
Oh, he'll push all right,
Thrawn said, his smile turning sardonic as he gazed out at the battle blazing on around the enemy convoy.
I've spent many hours studying Bothan art, Captain, and I understand the species quite well. There's no doubt at all that Counselor Phalia will play his part beautifully. As beautifully as if we were pulling his strings directly.
He tapped a key on his board.
Starboard batteries.
One of the frigates in the convoy is easing into attack position. Assume it's an armed backup and treat it accordingly. Squadrons A2 and A3, move to protect that flank until the frigate has been neutralized. The batteries and TIE Wing Commander acknowledged, and some of the turbolaser fire began to track on the frigate.
And what happens if failure wins?
Pellion persisted.
Quickly, I mean, before all this political confusion has a chance to set in. By your own analysis of the species, any Bothan who's risen as high as failure has would have to be highly intelligent.
Intelligent, yes, but not necessarily in any way that's dangerous to us, Thrawn said. He'd have to be a survivor, certainly, but that kind of verbal skill doesn't necessarily translate into military competence.
He shrugged.
Actually, a victory by failure would merely prolong the whole awkward situation for the enemy. Given the kind of support failure's been cultivating among the Rebellion military, the politicians would have to go through another polarizing struggle when they realized their mistake and tried to replace him.
Yes, sir.
Pellion said, suppressing a sigh. It was the kind of tangled subtlety that he'd never really felt comfortable with. He just hoped the Grand Admiral was right about the potential gains. It would be a shame for intelligence to have engineered such a brilliantly successful bank job and then not get anything of real value out of it.
Trust me, Captain, Thrawn said into his unspoken worries. I dare say the wasting of political effort has already begun, in fact. Ackbar's staunchest allies would hardly have left Coruscant at this critical point unless they were desperately searching for evidence to clear him.
Pellion frowned at him.
Are you saying that Solo and Organa Solo are headed for the Palani system?
Solo only, I think,
Thrawn corrected thoughtfully.
Organa Solo and the Wookiee are most likely still trying to find a place to hide from our Nogri. But Solo will be going to Palani.
Firmly convinced by intelligence's electronic sleight of hand that the trail leads through that system. Which is why the Death's Head is on its way there right now.
I see,
Pellion murmured. He'd noticed that order on the daily log, and had wondered why Thrawn was pulling one of their best Imperial Star Destroyers off battle duty.
I hope it will be equal to the task. Solo and Skywalker have both proved hard to trap in the past. I don't believe Skywalker is going to Palani, Thrawn told him, his face settling into a somewhat sour expression. Our esteemed Jedi Master apparently called it correctly. Skywalker has decided to pay a visit to Jomark.
Pellion stared at him.
Are you sure, Admiral? I haven't seen anything from intelligence to that effect.
The information wasn't from intelligence, Thrawn said. It came from Delta Source.
Ah,
Pellion said, feeling his own expression go a little sour. The Chimera's intelligence section had been nagging him for months now to find out what exactly this Delta Source was that seemed to feed such clear and precise information to the Grand Admiral from the very heart of the Imperial Palace. So far, all Thrawn would say was that Delta Source was firmly established and that the information gained through it should be treated as absolutely reliable. Intelligence hadn't been able to figure out whether Delta Source was a person, a droid, or some exotic recording system that was somehow able to elude the Rebellion's hourly counterintelligence sweeps of the palace. It irritated them to no end. And Pellion had to admit he didn't like much being kept in the dark about it either. But Thrawn had personally activated Delta Source, and long years of unwritten protocol in such matters gave him the right to keep the contact confidential if he chose.
I'm sure Sabaoth will be pleased to hear it,
he said.
I presume you'll want to give him the news yourself.
He thought he'd hidden his irritation with Sabaoth reasonably well. Apparently he'd thought wrong.
You're still upset about T'Nab, Thrawn said, turning to gaze out at the battle. It wasn't a question.
Yes, sir, I am,
Pellion said stiffly.
I've been over the records again, and there's only one possible conclusion. Sabaoth deliberately went beyond the battle plan Captain Aben had laid out. Went beyond it to the point of disobeying a direct order. I don't care who Sabaoth is or whether he felt justified or not. What he did constitutes mutiny.
It did indeed, Thrawn agreed calmly. Shall I throw him out of the Imperial service altogether, or simply demote him in rank?
Pellion glared at the other.
I'm serious, Admiral.
So am I, Captain, Thrawn countered, his voice abruptly cold. You know full well what's at stake here. We need to utilize every weapon at our disposal if we're to defeat the Rebellion.
Sabaoth's ability to enhance coordination and battle efficiency between our forces is one of those weapons. And if he can't handle proper military discipline and protocol, then we bend the rules for him.
And what happens when we've bent the rules so far that they come around and stab us in the back?
Pellion demanded.
He ignored a direct order at T'Nab. Maybe next time it'll be two orders, then three, then four. Until finally he's doing what he damn well pleases and ablazes with the Empire. What's to stop him?
Initially, the Isla Mari, Thrawn said, gesturing at the odd-looking tubular frameworks scattered around the bridge, each with an elongated furry creature wrapped around it, each of them creating a bubble in the Force where none of Sabaoth's Jedi tricks would work.
That's what they're here for, after all.
That's all well and good,
Pellion said.
But in the long run...
In the long run, I will stop him.
Thrawn cut him off, touching his board.
Squadron C-3, watch your Port Zenith flank. There's a blister on that frigate that could be a cluster trap.
The commander acknowledged, the TIE interceptors veering away in response. A second later, half a heartbeat too late, the blister abruptly exploded, sending a withering hail of concussion grenades outward in all directions. The rearmost of the TIE interceptors was caught by the edge of the fiery flower, shattering in a brilliant secondary explosion. The rest, out of range, escaped the booby trap unharmed.
Thrawn turned his glowing eyes on Pellion. I understand your concerns, Captain, he said quietly. What you fail to grasp, what you've always failed to grasp, is that a man with Sabaoth's mental and emotional instabilities can never be a threat to us. Yes, he has a great deal of power, and at any given moment he could certainly do considerable damage to our people and equipment. But by his very nature, he's unable to use that power for any length of time. Concentration,
focus,
long-term thinking. Those are the qualities that separate a warrior from a mere flailing fighter. And they're qualities Sabaoth will never possess. Pelion nodded heavily. He still wasn't convinced, but there was